Rootslandnation.com. Listen to back episodes of the podcast. Stream original music. Check out the latest fashions. Rootslandnation.com. We're your culture.
Osiris.
The Rootsland Podcast. Stories that are music to your ears.
I've got no time, but I've got some time to eat your story.
Oh, take this veil from off my eyes.
Deep in the culture, me deep in the culture. Deep in the culture, me love your jaw. Deep in the culture, me deep in the culture. Deep in the culture, me love your jaw. Most man that about me and them and bread drinking. As night come, them just a joy.
In early May 1993, I drove from my apartment in Merivale close to Halfway Tree, around 8 o'clock in the evening. Kingston's brutal rush hour traffic had started to subside. As I made my way down Constant Spring Road, the offices were officially closed at JBC, the Jamaican Broadcasting Company, but security was still tight. It was always tight at the compound of Jamaica's largest radio and TV station. The armed guard checked my driver's license and made sure it matched the name on his list before opening up the heavy metal gate and letting me in. I passed through one more checkpoint before heading upstairs where Eddie Fitzroy was waiting for me, in the accounting department where he had worked for the past two decades. His co-workers, gone for the day. Our meeting felt clandestine, like it was a spy thriller. We had used code words and made sure not to say too much on the telephone line. In my backpack, two dozen legal-sized manila envelopes, each containing copies of Eddie's new single, Deep in My Culture, which just came out on my Henry K label, distributed by Tuff Gong Music, the company started by Bob Marley and the Wailers back in the 70s. This was our second single from the upcoming album. Our first song, Love the People Want, was released on Eddie's Confidence label about a month prior and climbed right to the top of the local reggae charts. By 1993, after living in Kingston for 2 years, hustling records out of the back of my Russian-made Neva Jeep, I finally caught a break. Conscious singer Eddie Fitzroy agreed to let me produce his new album. It was a welcome opportunity for me and my upcoming label, which was struggling to get a foothold in this crowded reggae marketplace. Eddie was a respected and revered artist with a unique, unmistakable voice, along with being warm and approachable. He was a fan favorite wherever he performed in the world. Like fellow singer Half Pint, Eddie was caught in this transformative period as Jamaican roots reggae with its live instrumentation shifted to the age of dancehall and its computer-generated rhythms and sequenced drum patterns. In order to stay relevant, it required a delicate balancing act where these new roots artists needed to maintain the lyrical integrity at reggae's core while managing to move musically with the times, make use of the digital revolution, by recording songs that can fit into the current mix. These were lessons I learned while producing Deep in My Culture with Eddie. The record sharpened my engineering and production skills, built my confidence by giving me credibility in the studios and on the Kingston streets, where people noticed an artist of Eddie's caliber was willing to stake his reputation on a young producer like me. Working with Eddie further taught me about the harsh realities of Jamaica's music business. What happens outside the studio walls, in the shadows, and in backroom dealings, that it wasn't this idealistic fantasy land that I perceived it to be, that I wanted it to be. You see, Eddie's passion in life, his calling, was reggae. He spent his life singing, performing, recording conscious tracks, such as Youth Man Penitentiary, Check For You Once, Princess Black, Prison Life, First Class Citizen, The Gun, Easy Ride, eternal crowd pleasers that made local and international charts, a catalog embedded into reggae's history. Songs that still tear up parties and dances. But we know the way the system is set up in Jamaica, controlled by the powerful labels and producers that yield all the profits, with very little trickling down to the artists and writers. Which meant as successful as Eddie was in music, he still needed to keep his day job to help cover his bills and healthcare expenses. As much as Eddie loved singing, making music, there was something he loved even more. His family, his wife and kids. Seeing them happy, knowing they were secure, was well worth him sacrificing his career for. Because of this commitment to his family is why he was so beloved by reggae fans and fellow musicians. During the day, he was Fitzroy Edwards, mild-mannered accountant at the JBC. But at night, he would rip off his suit and tie to become Eddie Fitzroy, the working-class reggae hero. Still in Jamaica, in order to get a song on the radio or played by a major sound system, it took more than being a devoted co-worker, beloved singer, or reggae superhero. It took money, favors, bribes, payoffs, payola, or even other forms of encouragement or intimidation. There are the iconic stories of Bob Marley and the Wailers roughing up and threatening DJs to get their songs played on the radio. And since I was a lover and not a fighter, along with my backpack full of manila envelopes and Deep in My Culture 45s, I also had a pocket full of US $20 bills to place in each envelope. By tomorrow morning, those records will be in the mailbox of every influential radio DJ, reporter, TV presenter, and media personality on the island. And that would be just the jumpstart we needed. Both singles and the album Deep in My Culture would reach the top of the Jamaican charts. Tough Kong would sell thousands of units. Eventually, we would sign a deal with US-based Massive Music to press and distribute our record for all of North America. Of course, I would have loved for this to happen in an organic way. But it was an open secret that the most influential players in the Jamaican music industry were on the take, used their leverage to line their pockets. The early 90s were still the days when you could slip a disc jockey or selector a $20 bill and get a song rinsed on the radio or in the dance, which meant heavy rotation airplay. If it got a good response, it kept getting played. If not, just faded away. By the new millennium, these small payoffs and little bribes would become obsolete and replaced by large-scale, more institutionalized corruption. You see, now that corporate Jamaica realized the amount of clout and revenue the entertainment business could generate, neither the music or the business would ever be the same. And just like music conglomerates up in the United States, once Jamaica's power brokers took hold of the industry, they consolidated their grip, and to this day, have never let go. Fast forward a decade to 2004. Actually, I think that's a rewind, but it's okay. After a few years of self-imposed exile from Kingston, I was back living and working in Jamaica. Set up a little home studio up in Red Hills, and by chance or fate, or both, found myself producing the upcoming dancehall duo, Twin of Twins. Hailing from the Chisholm Avenue garrison of Kingston 13, they were an underground musical and comedic sensation, whose mixtapes were the hottest thing on the streets of Kingston. The group was the brainchild of Patrick Curly Locks Gaynor, a Grammy-nominated singer and songwriter, and featured his identical twin brother, Paul, PKA Two Locks. Their satirical skits and parodies were like a Jamaican version of Saturday Night Live, poking fun at some of the most controversial issues and current events in politics, entertainment, and pop culture. In December 2004, we released the album Crucifixion of the Ghetto, and the twins were thrust from their underground obscurity into the mainstream. The record hit number one on the album charts. We couldn't manufacture CDs quick enough to keep up with the demand at the record shops. The album featured the twins' off-brand humor, they called gangster comedy, along with social commentary, voice impersonations, and original songs that often got lost in the shuffle as listeners were fixated on their skits and comedic routines. One of the reasons that Twin of Twins struck a chord with Jamaicans of all classes, races, and political leanings, in both yard and abroad, was the content and message of the album. Crucifixion of the Ghetto was a stinging rebuke to the island's elite ruling class, who for decades did their best to suppress the nation's poor and disenfranchised populations, and to fight ghetto culture and music, Remember, Uptown Jamaica called Bob Marley a dirty, low-class, weed-smoking dread. And dancehall, Booyaga music. They passed laws to limit the street dances, enacted radio bans on songs, criticized lyrical content, dehumanized artists and musicians. That was all until, what? That's right. They saw that Jamaican music generated revenue. Lots of money. Bling bling. There was gold and green in reggae's red, gold, and green. And that's all they needed to know. These powerful and well-connected elites that controlled Jamaica since the days of slavery, they viewed the island's music and musicians just like any other commodity they were entitled to own, manufacture, or distribute. So as Curly Locks eloquently describes, Jamaica's upper class began their systematic and methodical crucifixion of the ghetto, alienating and cutting off poor people from each other, and then the rest of society. They hijacked and appropriated ghetto culture for themselves and their own personal and financial gain. It was, in fact, a hostile corporate takeover of reggae and dancehall that included revising the music's history, cleansing it, sanitizing it, making it more palatable for legitimate audiences. They did their very best to scrub the filthy ghetto elements from the music. This Jamaican industrial music complex, a cabal of influential producers, managers, media personalities, and outlets, anointed themselves as guardians of reggae's galaxy. The gatekeepers who get to decide who and what reached the outside world from their small little island. The first step in their conquest. They used dancehall to squeeze reggae and Rasta music out of the picture. They knew that Rastafarians would never conform or bow to that level of corporate Babylon. So they used their machine to discredit reggae as old school, outdated, and obsolete. And the masses bought in. And once that shiny metal object of dancehall became the only game in town, ghetto superstars like Shaba Ranks, Super Cat, Beanie Man, and Bounty Killer were forced to the back of the bus so the Shaggies and Sean Pauls of the world could be seated right up front. These non-threatening, light-skinned, clean-cut wonder boys that understood how to play the game and when to say the right things. Shaggy being a former Marine, talk about clean-cut and discipline. And Sean Paul Henriquez, a high school water polo champ from one of the island's oldest and most influential families. However, what these corporate geniuses that hijacked Jamaican music failed to recognize in their crucifixion of the ghetto was that by removing the poor, the disenfranchised, the ghetto sufferers from reggae and dancehall, you no longer have reggae or dancehall. What's left behind is a lifeless, soulless, empty vessel of sound. Jamaica is the land that brought forth the talent of Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailer, the bands Black Uhuru, Third World, Burning Spear, Culture, Toots and the Maytals, groups that toured the world. They took the abuse, the dirty looks, the racism, in order to kick in doors so future generations of Jamaican talent wouldn't have to endure those hardships, so they could walk in with their heads held high. What did the island of Jamaica and their inept rulers do to build on these stepping stones of these foundation artists and their groundbreaking work?
Nothing.
In their quest to corner the market, they undercut the culture and sold out the ghettos. They did nothing to ensure a new generation of singers and musicians emerged from the inner cities. They didn't set up music education programs or instruction in schools. They didn't offer courses in the rich history of ska, rocksteady, or reggae. No one bothered to take the time or effort to explain to these ghetto kids how Jamaican music was a vehicle for an entire generation of impoverished youth to escape the slums and become self-sufficient. Instead of creating a thriving, flourishing musical tapestry in the tenement yards, these all-knowing, all-seeing custodians of this precious art form let the music go extinct. Let me ask a question. As of recording this episode, how many Jamaican acts are currently on the iTunes Top 40 Most Downloaded Reggae Albums charts? Other than, of course, Bob Marley's two records. How many Jamaicans on the Top 40?
0.0.
That's right. 0.0. Congratulations, Jamaica. That's quite an astounding feat. I mean, statistically, is that even possible? What are the odds that a country that invented a genre is no longer even relevant in that genre? How about this little nugget? Who is Jamaica's most streamed artist of 2023? The answer? Sean Paul. That's right, Sean Paul. No, I didn't say 2003. I said 2023. And no disrespect to Sean Paul, but he's been doing that same shtick for 20 years. And he was just recycling Supercat style from the 80s. So that means there's been no innovation in the world of reggae in almost half a century. Well, actually, I shouldn't say no innovation, because reggae is alive and well. There's just not any coming out of Jamaica. Which literally brings me to the Cali Roots Music Festival and my pilgrimage to Monterey, California, a sacred space that many consider the New Jerusalem, the modern-day Mecca for reggae's faithful. As you know, the reason I originally decided to do Kingston to Cali was to address the concerns of so many of my listeners, authentic reggae lovers in Jamaica and throughout the world. They wanted to know whether this California progressive roots movement somehow represents an appropriation of Jamaica's indigenous music, which is always a valid point when discussing the evolution of any art form, especially one developed from inner city experiences and ghetto culture. However, when it comes to reggae, the issue is much more complex, being that one of the foundations and central principles of reggae music is that people of all races and colors and religions should have the right to pursue whatever they want in life, regardless of who they are and where they come from. So when a white or Latin or Asian teen from the suburbs wants to be a reggae singer, they're just following the ideals instilled in them by listening to reggae music in the first place. So is that cultural appropriation? Or is that what reggae music is meant to be? Let me start off by saying that I went to Cali Roots with two of my closest friends from childhood. Dougie Dredd, a music enthusiast and former host of Brown University's Reggae Radio Hour. And the Baumer, a Long Island legend, world traveler, and high life connoisseur. We've been going to shows and attending concerts together for 40 years. So regardless, it was going to be one for the ages. Which it was. Furthermore, we were lucky enough to be invited to stay with fans and friends of the Rootsland podcast. Big up Josh and Judy, who have a beautiful home on Monterey Bay, just a 10-minute walk from the venue. It was like being among family. And the piece de la resistance to a magical weekend. It had been over 20 years since my last reggae show in California. Bob Marley Day at the Long Beach Arena in 2001. And while so much has changed in music and the world since that day, I was pleasantly surprised that one thing was remarkably similar. The reggae fans. They're still the greatest. I love the vibe of the crowd at Cali Roots. It was reminiscent of an old-school reggae audience, groups of friends that reminded me of myself and my crew back in the day. They were respectful, engaging, fun to be around. And also like my teenage crew, most were burning some pretty pungent sensimilia. It was one big family, with parents comfortable enough to bring their children, and infants in strollers. Which says so much. Fans were decked out in Cali Roots merch dating back over a decade. There were extended families, young couples, multi-ethnic and multi-generational revelers of every ilk, class, and persuasion. And whether they were listening to Stick Figure or Revolution, the reigning dons of Cali Roots culture, or reggae icons the Marley Brothers and Burning Spear, the audience was fully engaged, energized, appreciative of the performances. Myself and my friends, along with everyone else around us, had an amazing time. That being said, my experience as a fan was quite different than my experience as the host of a number one music history podcast, with an anxious audience expecting answers on whether the Cali Roots movement has reggae music's long-term interest at heart. I spent 4 decades as a foot soldier in reggae's army. When I was younger, I was afraid to speak up. I wanted to be liked. Besides, no one wanted to hear what I had to say. And the truth is, I'm still a foot soldier. I was never very good at taking orders. But the difference is now I found my voice, and I no longer fear speaking truth to power. And my first and biggest concern regarding Cali Roots is too much power in the hands of too few people, which is exactly the same circumstances that decimated Jamaica's music business, which is the last thing I want to see happen out in Cali. This year's festival consisted of approximately 30 acts, with 5 out of the 30 Jamaican artists. And 3 out of the 5 Jamaicans were Marley Brothers. There was also only one female solo act on the festival, Claire Wright, although the group Article Sound System does have a female vocalist. But the stat to me that's most alarming is that the majority of performers on this year's lineup are signed to one of just two companies, either Silverback Artist Management or Ineffable Music Group. And things start to look even more like what's happening in Jamaica, with double dipping and conflicts of interest. Because Ineffable Music, besides managing many of the artists on the festival, is also a partner in the festival. They produce it, along with thousands of other shows a year, including most of the major reggae concerts. So besides being a promoter, management company, and media company, they do back one of the biggest and most influential reggae websites in the world. Ineffable Records, the label arm of Ineffable Music Group, is, according to their website, Billboard's top independent label in the genre of reggae. So I guess that means we now know who to ask why there are no Jamaican artists on the iTunes Top 40 reggae charts, right? I mean, when you have these big corporations that have their hands in so many pots, there's bound to be conflicts, lines being crossed. And that creates doubts on whether you're giving the people what they want to hear or what you want them to hear. One such instance of these blurred lines that upset a lot of musicians and members of Jamaica's musical fraternity was an incident surrounding the recent Grammy Awards. And no, I'm not talking about Soja, the first American band to win a Grammy in 2022. I'm talking about the subsequent years, 2023 and 2024. It's been a long-standing tradition, an unspoken rule in reggae circles, that you never nominate a single rhythm various artist's LP for Grammy consideration. It's an insult to the music, and to all the groups and musicians who take the time and effort to produce albums that feature 10, 11, or 12 songs on different musical compositions and rhythms. However, for the past 2 years, Ineffable Music has violated that code with their Cali Roots 2023 and 2024 Various Artist albums. I know they nominated as Cali Buds and Various Artist LP, but there are 22 friggin' bands on that record, all performing different songs on the same rhythm. And I can't find one where Cali Buds actually sings. And when you have almost 24 groups on just one album, between the band members, the management teams, and record labels, with all those voters, the math alone gets you the nomination, whether you deserve it or not. Which is the reason why compilation albums have always been discouraged from the Grammys. It's an uneven playing field. There's no glory in that kind of victory. It's just another trophy for the shelf. At the same time, that spot you forced your way onto by sheer numbers means there was one less opening for a truly deserving Jamaican artist that could have been nominated for that Grammy. And last year, there were some great candidates who should have made the list. Anthony B., I Octane, Honor Rebel, Jamali, Richie Spice. For an aspiring singer, or even a veteran who hasn't given up on the dream of winning a Grammy, do you know how discouraging that can be? How heartbreaking? You put your heart and soul, what little finances you have, to produce an album that doesn't take shortcuts, has varied musical styles and compositions, just hoping for that coveted Grammy nomination, or even a win that could change your life, only to find out the process is rigged against you because you're not part of some well-connected team. So the question begs to ask, if a record company is willing to go through such lengths for nothing more than some clout and prestige, if they're willing to put a stumbling block before an upcoming Jamaican artist, dash away their hopes and dreams, what else would they be willing to do in their own self-interest? Are there any lines they won't cross? One of the greatest accomplishments of the Cali Roots Festival is that it went green over a decade ago, incorporating sustainability into their core business operations. The festival is now one of Monterey's certified green businesses, which gives me an idea. Why doesn't Cali Roots become a certified red, gold, and green business and incorporate reggae sustainability into their core business operations? Listen, I understand that Cali Roots Festival wouldn't exist without Monterey. But let's face it, Cali Roots wouldn't exist without reggae either, right? I understand the cost and complexities of bringing artists in from Jamaica for the show. But think about how much time and money has been invested into the commitment to go green and the payoff for that investment. They say the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today. Imagine if every year Cali Roots was able to find some raw, undiscovered newcomer from the ghettos and tenement yards of Jamaica and give them the opportunity to appear on the Cali Root stage, in front of an audience of that magnitude. Imagine the impact it would have on a young life. And if you did that every festival, for the next 20 years, it would be like planting a forest of future reggae stars. And please, Cali Roots, don't get caught up in this jealous crab-in-a-barrel mentality that put Jamaican music on life support. The more singers and bands and DJs, MCs, and rappers that rise up from Jamaica, the better for everyone. Putting focus and attention back on authentic reggae from Jamaica could only help the entire genre, the festival, the labels, and management companies in the Cali Roots movement. There's room for everyone. And while we're on the topic of reggae sustainability, how about every year picking out a classic reggae album, a masterpiece from the island's vaults, and have each one of the headliners cover a song or two from the record? It would be a great way of placing the spotlight on one of the genre's founding fathers, a no-cost way of giving something back to the music. And if you're feeling generous, the festival could even take a few-minute break from hawking the Cali Roots merch on the big screens and highlight the album's artwork and info on the monitor, so the audience would know how to find the song and stream it. Or even better, how about at every festival you can offer a merchandising booth or a little area to the Jamaican Tourist Board or the island's small hotel association or chamber of commerce to help promote tourism on the island and the Jamaican economy? They could even sell a hat or a t-shirt for a down-and-out artist in need of a little extra income. I'm sure you could find a way to use it as a tax write-off, like you do with the Surfrider Foundation booth. Yeah, man, it would be easy. Okay, so it's probably time for that talk. You know, the one about cannabis sativa. Or as Junior Gong calls it, the greatest plant in the history of mankind. One of the most profound moments at Cali Roots for my friend Dougie Dredd occurred in an area of the festival known as the Sesh Lounge, which was basically a covered outdoor patio area set up as a cannabis safe space, complete with sanitized house bongs available for loan, providing they were returned in a timely manner. Although the lounge didn't provide any cannabis, patrons of the sesh left large donations of sticky kind buds for those in need. And by chance the donation dish was empty, you couldn't take three steps without someone offering you a sample of their brand strain of high percentage THC flower, or gummy, or chocolate, or cannabis-infused drinks. It was a potpourri like no other we had experienced. A moment not lost on Dougie Dredd, who took the time to remind us that we all grew up in a generation that would risk jail time, or even worse by driving into the worst areas of Far Rockaway, Queens, to buy dime bags of brown weed from a dilapidated bicycle shop on Nami Oak Avenue. And as bad as we had it, there were real heroes who fought courageously on the front lines to help legalize cannabis. And although everywhere I looked, I saw the spoils of the victory, nowhere did I see a tribute to the soldiers who fought the war. If the Cali Roots Festival can arrange sponsors to set up a sesh lounge and a smoke tent full of various dispensaries and cannabis shops, how about an exhibit to these reggae and hip-hop legends that helped fight for the legalization and normalization of cannabis long before it was popular and trendy? Cannabis culture is such a central part of the Cali Roots experience and California in general. I feel people take it for granted, unaware of the hardships and heavy price that so many people had to pay for us to enjoy this moment. Cali Roots fans should be aware that reggae icons Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailer, Toots Hibbert all went to prison for ganja. They sacrificed valuable years of their lives for being outspoken advocates for the legalization of cannabis sativa. They were targeted by the system, who recognized how influential these reggae artists were, but they never backed down from their stance, and they paid the price. In fact, Toots and the Maytels' song, 5446, is about him going to jail for herb. That was the number they gave him when he got locked up. He said they stripped him of all his humanity. In those days, Rastafarians were beaten, abused, for extolling the medicinal properties of the Ola herb. We need to honor these heroes. So when people strolling through the smoke tent or chilling at the sesh lounge know who to thank for their next hit, besides the dude that donated the kind bud. Some people see a bowl half full. Some see it half smoked. One person who's an eternal optimist is reggae singer Half Pint, Lyndon Roberts. And since he's such an integral part and influential voice in both Jamaican reggae and Cali roots, I'm reminded of his classic song, One Big Family, that came out on the same album as his hit Greetings. It was voiced on the famed Death in Arena rhythm, usually drawn in a dance to kill a rival sound. Yet in Half Pint's case, his song is about love and unity and togetherness. In Jamaica, a selector usually plays One Big Family at the end of the night, when the crowd is feeling nice and the vibes are sweet. And when people hear that song, they put their petty differences aside and are reminded about the things in life that are truly important, and how the things that connect us, like love and hope and faith, are so much stronger than the things that divide us. Later in the song are the lyrics, "Take care of my son, and I'll take care of yours. Come tomorrow, we won't live in sorrow." I remember Half Pint talking about growing up in the ghetto back in the day. And no matter how strained or tough times were, you could always count on your neighbor to have your back. You treated other children as if they were your own and watched over them. And I think that's a philosophy that reggae music's One Big Family needs to adopt. Whether you're Cali roots or progressive roots, Afrobeat or reggaeton, ska rock steady or reggae, we all need to band together. One family tree. And understand that we are eternally connected. What affects one affects all. And the stronger the roots, the longer and wider all the branches will grow.
RootslandNation.com. Listen to back episodes of the podcast. Stream original music. Check out the latest fashions. RootslandNation.com. Wear your culture.